Welcome to another Saturday night at the Vancouver Institute. We've got a wonderful crowd for celebration for a local hero tonight. And seeing this crowd, many of you, I think, are probably here for the first time this winter. And we have a new, wonderful way for you to celebrate. When you go out, you sign up for a membership in the Vancouver Institute. You know, the lectures are free, but we count on the hundreds, sometimes thousands of people who join us as members of the Institute. It really makes you feel good, and I urge you to do that when you leave. Today, our lecture is by Bing Tom, who's talking about building a new city in China. We at the Institute decided that this would likely be a week of profound change in China, and therefore, months ago, we scheduled this lecture about building in the new China. And who better to do it than Bing? He's not only a local boy from our own school of architecture, he's left a major imprint on the city. He worked in a long apprenticeship with Arthur Erickson before he established his own practice. And Bing not only was a major figure in things like the new courthouse, he was also the chairman of the committee that chose the architect for the new library. There are many, many ways in which Bing has left his impression, and he keeps on, there were many things that he will do. He's leaving a major impression on our present campus with the new Convocation Center, a building which is growing and growing and growing, and it will grow on all of you. And so Bing clearly has a major following in his hometown of Vancouver. Tonight he's going to talk to us on from the ground up, designing and building a new city in China. Please give a warm welcome to Bing Tom.
Thank you very much, Eric. It's a great honor to come back to your alma mater and speak at an important occasion like this for the Institute. It's always daunting, you know, to have in the audience all your old professors and old fellow students. And so I will hope that you will find the presentation useful. I'm going to start first with a short video clip that CBC just recently made with me in China. They came this fall. It's Joyce Resin and Patty Moore with the program called Alive. Alive, as you know, is a program on CBC that runs every week, and it basically deals with health. And in speaking with them, they thought it was interesting to talk about healthy city. So I'm going to start by putting the video on. Can everybody hear me all right? No? Okay, so I'm going to start by putting on a short video clip. It's produced by CBC this fall in China. I went with them to Dalian. So I thought this would give you the quickest introduction to the city itself and how the city feels today, okay?
It begins with a dream of a model city, a model of health. Just imagine being able to build a city from the ground up. It's every architect's dream. Well, it's a dream coming true for well-known Canadian architect Bing Tom on this site in the north of China. Comes here with a team of developers, engineers, and planners, and with some well-established credentials. Wing Chun has received the Order of Canada for his architectural designs around the world. And he has a vision for this land.
I think building a civilization is 3,000 years old. That can reinvent the meaning of what is a healthy city. And it's a wonderful opportunity.
An opportunity not to be missed. Because as far as healthy cities are concerned, China needs help. Some of the world's worst examples of pollution and overcrowding are found here. But this part of China is different. This is the site of the future city of New Dalian. It's 300 kilometers east of Beijing in the area anciently known as Manchuria. The new town will be a satellite to the old city of Dalian. Current population, 3 million. Dalian is unlike any other Chinese city. It's cosmopolitan and vibrant. It's a fairly modern metropolis that prides itself on being worldly, beautiful, and stylish. This annual cultural celebration, the Dalian International Fashion Festival, is proof. In a week-long extravaganza every fall, talent from throughout the world is showcased here. And the fashions rival the ramps of Hong Kong or Paris. Why is this city so different from others in China? The spark plug is its forward-thinking, can-do mayor, Bo Xilai, sometimes described as a young JFK. Dalian is also especially favored by Beijing to be a world-class example of China's face to the future. Work here has been exceptional, even by Asian standards. Dalian is attracting billions of dollars in capital investment from around the world. And those investments are attracting millions of new citizens, Chinese and foreign. And they all need somewhere to live. That's why they want to build a new Dalian, just outside the old city.
The scale of the undertaking that's going on in China is absolutely mind-boggling. I mean, I don't think any architect has encountered this kind of magnitude of problem.
And the mayor wants the new Dalian to be healthy and modern.
Of course, Dalian is a Chinese city. Mm-hmm. But still, we keep some Chinese tradition. But at the same time, I'd like to invite all of the European shops and European designers come to Dalian to create something special.
So the mayor invited architects from around the world to compete to build the new city. Bing Tom started his plan by considering the people already in the area.
We found that the people in this area really have a great respect for the Big Black Mountain, which is around this area, and the Yellow Sea. So we felt that this city is the bridging gap between the Big Black Mountain and the Yellow Sea. And in this area, they have a tradition towards the sea goddess, the goddess of the sea. And when there were areas in the old cities, they have built towers, we call viewing the city, viewing the ocean towers. So what we did in these new towers, we recreated these towers right at the edge, the most forefront part of the city as it meets the ocean. So these are the ocean viewing towers of the new city. So we really try to integrate that tradition of strong attachment to the sea. These are seagoing people that make their living from the sea. They struggle against the sea. The sea was not always friendly to us, but they relied on the sea for their living. So this is a seafront city that thrusts itself out from the mountain to the sea in a very powerful way.
His plan calls for a compact city center to avoid urban sprawl and to keep the city core alive.
The great cities of the world are cities that are compact and very vibrant because Mother Nature in some way forced them to be. Look at Hong Kong. It's built smack up against the hills and it's got Kowloon and Hong Kong with a harbor in the middle that joins it. You look at New York, Manhattan, it's an island. You look at San Francisco, downtown, it's an island.
Reducing cars reduces pollution and encourages walking. His pollution control plans also include using the prevailing winds and tides to cleanse the city and encouraging every building to be as environmentally friendly as possible.
If you have each building healthy on its own, you don't have to build as many hospitals. So here, if each building is healthy, we don't have to build as many sewage treatment plants.
Bingtong's plans include reducing, reusing, and recycling.
For example, in the toilet, if you put your sink on top of the toilet as you wash your hands, the wastewater from washing your hand goes into the tank, which then can be used to flush the toilet.
In Bing's plan, New Dalian will have plenty of green space and a respect for the existing trees.
We're building the town center and the major green space around these trees because we think it's healthy to have this in the new city, to have a connection with the past. Even though we will be planting new trees and additional trees, these particular trees are part of their history. It's vital that they keep them.
The issue of equitable access to the city starts right from the planning stage. What happens to the farmers and the fishermen who are living right in this area when this new big city gets developed?
They have a share in the development of this new land. They are part of the ownership of this development.
That means the local people have an investment in the new town. They'll own the farms and the fish markets of the future city, and they have construction jobs today. Bing Tom has lots of ideas for the new Dalian, but it's a big job. Can you do it?
I don't think we can fool ourselves. We're just one little speck in a big ocean, and we just take one step at a time. I mean, it's going to take many, many people to see this vision through.
But that vision is coming through. Bing Tom's team won the competition. In September, Mayor Bo Xilai gave the green light to Bing's dream for the new Dalian.
Very nice. He is a genius.
And with that approval, construction work has already begun on the world's newest healthy city. Bing Tom is confident that people will be living in New Dalian by the end of this century. From dream to reality, just 3 years from now. Next on Live, a healthy city works.
It's been said that unemployment is one of the highest stress factors in some.
Sorry for the technical glitch. Well, that's the end of the lecture. Thank you. So I think before going further into the detail of the design, I want to introduce you to one very important member of the team, Dr. Liu Dengyang. I was very, very fortunate in this project through an introduction of Professor Bron Wiseman to Dengyang. Dengyang is an architect that's graduated in China from Tongji University in Shanghai. And am I speaking loud enough? Sorry. And he came to Canada as one of the first students from China to study planning and studied here at UBC and got his planning degree here under the tutelage of Bron Wiseman. And then after that, he went to the University of Manitoba and got a PhD in anthropology. And I got to know Dengyang because he did his PhD thesis on the Dr. Sun Yat-sen Garden, which for a third generation Chinese like me was quite astounding. For those of you who know China and China hands, it's, you know, the early immigrants coming to Canada are looked on like Quebecois by the French, you know, and they're lowly and not that educated. But to have a scholar from China interested in the early settlers of Canada and to try to find their history. So I was very taken by him. So later on when I got this commission to look at Dalian, immediately I remembered Dr. Liu, so I phoned him up, and of course he was in between jobs, so he said, sure, let's look at it. So I'd like to at this time turn the mic over to Dr. Liu, who will give you a sense of the history of Dalian, because he is from Shenyang, which is about 2 or 3 hours drive from Dalian, and so he's a local boy, and so without him I don't think we could have carried on this work nearly to the degree that we did. So Dr. Liu, would you come forward?
Thanks, Bing, and thanks for everyone here. I think I'm very honored some of you here, perhaps my teacher before, and I feel definitely grateful to both UBC and I think particularly to Asian Study Library, which I did a lot of research there. I'm just going to make a little short presentation for introduction on the context of Bali and the project, which may lead to the further presentation being given a little later. Is machine on? Yes. Okay. I think there are two maps in front of you. On the left side, probably as you have seen in the video, in the previous video, that's actually partial map of China, where Darwin's in the red square over there. I think that shows practically the relative position where Darwin is in terms of relating with both where Beijing is and Shanghai, and of course, Korea. The other side of that is the regional map of Greater Dalian, where about, I think right now, 5.2 million people dwell there. Dalian is interesting from this regional map because it's probably one of the biggest ports in northern eastern part of China. There, of course, there's three provinces there, and including the Inner Mongolia. Total population that which are using the port currently is about 110 million people. That tells you how much importance Dalian really has strategically in China right now. The original map shows there's the four clusters of so-called blue areas within the Metro Dalian area. On the little short corner of this side is a city called Lushuan, about 300,000 people living there, and also the mining the Chinese marine, there's a heavy marine base there. Upper part, and in the middle, surrounding, just right in the center, that's where the Dalian city is right now. And the upper north, a little bit, on the threshold over there, is a city called Jinzhou, in the Chinese, which meaning the city of gold. And the square it shows is where the new town is right now. As Bing has mentioned, Dalian is definitely a sea city. I guess just like Vancouver, people love to go out, particularly summertime. The temperature is very mild there. I think the lowest, coldest day in Dalian is minus 10. When in summer, I think I never remembered I used any air conditioner over there, even a fan. So it's really, I think, just maybe 30 plus for like a week. The rest of them is a really nice drizzle. A lot of sunshine, that's probably very unlike Vancouver. It rains very little, but it rains very heavily within 1 month in the summer, that is in August. I think the precipitation annually is about 800 millimeters, one-third, maybe a quarter of that in Vancouver. So water will and is and will be very precious to the people in Dalian. The map on this side, it's very old map. I found it actually in the Asian Study Library in UBC. It tells you how important we have that library here, which I didn't find this in China at all. The map was drawn in the year 1566 and was kept by the Japanese, I think a duke somehow, in somehow went back in UBC. When I got a project with Bing, I think I went back to UBC first to do some work, kind of footwork and research. I found this map in the historic books of Dalian. Clearly, this is not a map we see, usually Tibet, is very cognitive. In the upper part, you look at the upper square in the middle, that's the city of gold. Then there's a two little diamond like here on the lower corner on this side, on the west side, that's a city called Lushan. Then Dalian, at this location, of course, the new town has not yet been built. This map was drawn off in the year of 1566. So, tell a little bit about the history of this area. Most people in China think Dalian have no history at all, but, you know, which we found otherwise. The first city in this area was built about 2,000 years ago, approximately, BC, 200 BC. And typically it's a nine-square city with a city wall surrounding it. It is very important. The city actually guards the pathway towards to the ocean. On this side of the ocean, we call the Yellow Sea, which is part of the Pacific Ocean. That's the east side. On this side is the bay, that is the Bohai Sea. That's on this side. The first city was built, as I said, you know, in the first dynasty. When we were there, they were just dismantled the last bits of the city wall. I thought it was very pitiful. Then the second city in this area, which was typical like a Baroque city, was built in 1350, the end of 14th century. That is when the Han people, the Ming Dynasty, defeated the Mongolians. Then the people, the troops, attacked the Mongolians through this corner, which is through the Shandong province up north. And because there's always a violent waves in the ocean, but somehow the troops accomplished the victory. That's why they named this place as a peace of journey. Then, of course, Dalian was being built, I think started in the end of the 19th century, and of course there's a whole bunch of history going on with that. Dalian, there are many names for it. There are people call them a port of Arthur, you know, probably familiar with the British reader because of the Opium Wars. And Dalian, if I'm correct, it's also coming from the Russian name Dalian, which means the remote city. Of course, Dalian by no means is not shortage of cultural exchange. Just the map shows previously. There were and still are constant cultural exchanges of goods and services between the South and North, and Dalian definitely is the gateway. There were many people in there before, including the Koreans, the Mongolians, the Manchus, and of course the Han people. Most people living in Dalian now coming from actually South, in Shandong province. That's why linguistically there are phonetic resemblance between the people in Shandong and then the people in Dalian. They come about 200 years ago. What I thought this map is interesting, it really indicates a four types of city in China. The first one is typically the cosmic city, that dealing with the notion of man and nature in a very ancient conventional terms, you know, based on the city of geomancy, the feng shui. Then you come to another kind of Chinese city, which is typically military, that was built in the Ming Dynasty, very functional, as almost like a castle on the side, as the city Lushan is. And then you see Dalian actually come out, emerged in China, very much as the product of colonialism. By the year of 1899, when the Germans attacked Qingdao, which is across the other way of the sea, they built the city Qingdao. While the Russians attacked Dalian, then they start building a Baroque city on this land, as used to be a fishing village on this corner, with it, the port. Then 7 years later, in 1905 approximately, the Japanese beat the Russian troops. And then Japanese took over since then colonized until the end of Second World War. So there's a longer period of Japanese occupation within the Dalian area. And again, the city plan in the old Dalian, which is the new Dalian here, shows the influence of which is one-sided. The old map really shows there's a very typical Baroque city plan, it's the radiance and domes, beautiful kind of perspective streets with, you know, parallelized by the punctuated by squares and piazzas. And then, of course, overlay on top of that is very functional roadways, very much square and grids built by the Japanese planners. Well, Dalian became open since middle of '80s, of course, under the call for further modernization, and also this whole thing of opening special economic zones to foreign investors. Under that, Dalian became one of the four major so-called special economic zones in China, besides like Shenzhen, Zhuhai, and others you probably know already. Then the major investors in Dalian New Town right now, which is actually the new city is going to be based upon, come mostly from Japan, mostly the major including Toshiba, Sanyang, Canon, the big companies. The new town was built since 1986. Initially, we planned about 9 square kilometers. Then, because the speed is so fast, the complete building this new town, actually we call it Kaifachi, it's the special economic zone, within approximately like 6 years. So between 1986 and 1993, they finished approximately build area of 10 square kilometers. Then they step on another even bolder strike. They want to build a new city to actually, both accommodate the urbanization moves from the north and also putting Dalian into a major lead in the Chinese port functions. With that, they have this plan down, during early 90s, that's 1993, master plan done by the local planners in Dalian, as you probably see. Of course, we cannot talk about New Dalian without talking about the new port, which is called the Big Kingdom Bay. Now currently is invested by the Singapore investors. And if you see in the middle also, see that orange strip, that's supposedly the downtown core. And what the scale of that is about 7 kilometers long. And Small Kingdom Bay, as you see, we call it Little Kingdom Bay, that's where the downtown going to be, is also our project going to be limited. So this slide, the snapshot will show you what the built area will be look like today in the area of special economic zone. Both from distance. Back behind is the mountain called the Big Black Mountain. That's our site. And if you look the all the little black dots over this side, that's the build area already for the new town. Approximately now it's about 20 square kilometers, but they sold land for 40 already. As Bing had mentioned also, there are a quite strong rural tradition and I think a culture in very indigenous within this area. Because the culture is so hybrid and I think vital, it is really a mix of many kinds of belief.
I think we'll take that word just temporarily, believe there is a definition for belief. I think it's very discursive. I can't really label it as Taoism or Confucianism or Buddhism. I don't think it's none of those. It's perhaps a mix of everything and perhaps a mix of nothing. As most coastal cities in China do, people do actually worship the sea goddess, the statue we show here, including the people from Taiwan, Macau, Fujian province. So as the people in Dalian, they did, and still, some of the fishermen still worship the sea goddess. I think there's a reason for that. Even when I was there during the last 2 years, there were festivals when the fishermen do have an annual ceremony. They build a big paper boat, then of course throw this boat into the ocean, and then sending to the sea goddess. What's fascinating to me as an anthropologist, I think it's really interesting that nature has really taken many forms, including water and the mountains. And it has many facades. They seem differently to me. There are violent sides of nature, definitely. If you see the effects of typhoon that destroy the dam, it's very torturing and, I think, violent. Now, of course, there's a very peaceful side of water, too. Look at that. They call the Buddhist War Temple, hanging up right in the waist of this big black mountain, the sacred mountain in the region. There's no wood beam inside. The whole building was actually put right smack against a cave. And then there was a spring water dripping through the courtyard. And then, of course, there's a shimmery surface on the stone and flowing through the pathway going down the creek, flowing towards the ocean. And because there's shortage of water, there are all kinds of legends and stories about how water is important, including there is a goddess of a harp, which means, you know, the goddess of harp playing the harp and the people following the music find the spring to save the people from famine and, of course, the drought. Now, of course, from the history book. That's one of the... And that, you know, to show how vital the culture is, I think this is not something mandatory. It's something that cannot be destroyed. Look at the cubic over there. It's about 1 meter high. It was built by some anonymous fishermen. When we were there in 94, just right after one of the severest typhoons during that year, that summer, then some fishermen built that little shrine with a nice little curve. Inside it was this little name card writing on the name of sea goddess. And of course, there's an offering of food. So of course, there's such a respect towards the ocean. And I think, you know, we definitely could discuss in much lengthy discussions. And, you know, I think make a short conclusion. I think as both planners and architects, we have to be really, really sensitive to who are we dealing with, what kind of culture and natural context you are facing, and how, I think most importantly, how in your design, you really, really, really keep remember all the principles you just pinpointed, and then express them in both design forms and the planning, I think, practices. With that, I leave the for Mr. Bintang for further presentation. Thank you. Thank you, Dengyang. There's just a couple of points that I wanted to bring up was that we paid a lot of attention to history and culture, and this was very surprisingly to the local planning officials. For example, that particular map that Dongyang found, the minute we made it available to the city, the mayor especially, the very next day it appeared in the local newspaper. Because prior to that, when we asked the question about Dalian, they all said, well, the city's 100 years old because it was built by the Russians and the Japanese, right? And we said, no, it can't be. There must be more to it than that. So they were very quick to pick up the elements that we found. For example, the mythology of Big Black Mountain.
The farmer, the fisherman, they all knew about it. But the planning officials, which were all from Shanghai and Beijing, of course, they'd never been up to the mountain. They didn't know there were temples up there. And they were areas that we went to, they'd never been to, and some of them have lived there for 7 years. So they began to think of planning a little differently through the experience of working together with us. The drawings on the left are kind of analytical diagrams. Once again, there's the small Kiln Bay that we talked about, and this is the big Kiln Bay that Dongyang talked about. This showed the major features of the mountains and the hills, and it also showed that the summer the winds were coming from the south, in the north the winds were coming from the north in the winter. Existing on the site, this is the small Kiln Bay, were a series of salt farms, and we were supposed to put the new city by filling up the salt farms. And they had built a major highway through the salt farms, planned by some highway engineers out of Beijing. The widest roadway we have in Vancouver is about 40 meters, property lines to property line. This was about 120 meters wide. So obviously they were thinking of it for grand parades and whatever. But it's also potentially the major coastal highway linking all the way to Korea. You could drive from this area to the border of North Korea probably in half a day. So this gives you a sense of scale. The other reason why Dalian was purposely not developed, if you remember the earlier slides, it's on a very long peninsula, and they were very worried that Dalian could be totally cut off from the mainland by just a series of bombing raids. And so that was a leftover from the Korean Wars. So it wasn't until in the late 70s and 80s that Dalian became a vital port for China. Obviously, it's the best deep water port for all of Manchuria. As Dalian, as Dongyang mentioned, that's virtually half of the United States population going through one port. That's why it's so important. And here, there are two major rivers that are, let's call them streams, that drains into the small Kiln Bay. And this dotted line here shows the low tide line, and the high tide line, of course, comes all the way up to here. This is very much like Spanish Banks. I mean, it's probably twice the walk from shallow water to deep water. So the tide really recedes for a long ways, and that's why it was very successful at salt farms. But it became a major problem. How do you design a seafront city when you have tidal conditions like that? In the Big Kiln Bay, which is the next bay, we didn't have this problem, but in the Small Kiln Bay, you have this problem of the tidal flats. In addition to that, this is a record of 72 typhoons that came through Dalian, right there. Okay? Right there. And when we first got into the job, we had a sense this might be a typhoon area, so we made this long-distance phone call to the chief planner in Dalian, and we said, you know, we're a little worried about maybe you've got this new site right in the middle of a typhoon path. And the chief planner said, no, we don't have any typhoon problems. So obviously, the 1 week later after the phone call, Dongyang and I made a site visit to Dalian, and the typhoon just hit. And that's what happened to a brand new dike that they had built. And of course, when we spoke to the farmers, they said, well, of course, because these planners are living in Old Dalian. Old Dalian was very ingeniously sited because it had a mountain range to protect it from the typhoons, but this new site is right smack in the middle of the typhoon path. And he said, well, these guys never come to this site. Of course they don't know this is a problem. Yeah. So these are the kind of fishing villages that are in the Small Kiln Bay. You can see because of the tidal flats, they invented these ingenious ways of taking the small boats up onto the shore by these kind of cable cars. And then the villagers, of course, built these very beautiful little housing up in the hills. They have this tremendous love of this blue color, which we saw everywhere. And of course, the villagers were always very sensitive. They never built on top of the hill. They always built and left the top of the hill quite pure, and then built terracing down from the hill. And of course, this is the modern architecture, and everything goes, you know, anything that's new, and it's like Disneyland. But you can't really blame them, because I imagine for those of us who came to Vancouver maybe 100 years ago and you looked at some of the Shaughnessy houses, you probably have the same laugh, right? So we then said, okay, how do you go about, you know, designing a new city? So we said, well, the best way to start from history and look at what other people have done. These are defensive cities, very compact, working with nature and leaving, you know, large areas of farmland and not allowing the city to sprawl. These are imperial cities. And these are modern, well, one of this particularly failed capital cities in Brasilia, and this is Canberra. Canberra is very interesting in the series of geometric star-like shapes, and then using the mountains and the lakes for axes and vistas. But obviously, you know, for architects, if you get too hung up with geometry, geometry has its own way of stifling growth and creating patterns that are hard to deal with through time, through change, and change of values. And of course, then you have mercantile cities. New York started with the wharfs, and you can see the pattern of the streets dictated very much similar to Vancouver from these wharfs, and then the grid breaking down. This is Amsterdam, starting from the seafront and growing in concentric rings. So we have to study all of these kind of patterns, because ultimately you had to lay out some kind of grids. And of course, after the Second World War, we had all these new ideas about new cities. This is Candelas of Wood, linear cities that can grow infinitely in any direction, right? That just can grow in arms, or a hook, one of the British new towns. Also having some principle of the linear cities that allows it to grow linearly. And these linear city concepts had very strong influence in China. And so Dong Yang showed you this idea of their plan, which he earlier showed that they wanted a linear downtown that was stretching, you know, some 4 to 6 kilometers long, which would have resulted, I think, in a lot of sprawl. And obviously, we also have to look at the idea of seafront cities, Venice and some other villages in Italy, and the idea of seafront property always being valuable. So the whole idea of property values, taxation, was something that's new to the Chinese. We have to try to explain to them that when you lay out a city, you have to think of income that you derive from this land, and how to deal with property tax. Of course, China itself has a tradition of canal cities like Venice. This is Suzhou. The reason we looked at these is that the salt farms, if you remember earlier slides, had canals. And so we have this idea that maybe we should save the footprints of these canals as the beginning of a canal-like city for the new Dalian. And of course, then you had, you know, granddaddy of mercantile cities, Hong Kong, that just anything goes, and it goes, and it has its own beauty and its own charm. But until recently, at least, they're still leaving the peak, but now there's going to be a new building in Hong Kong that's going to be taller than the peak. So that's under great controversy in Hong Kong right now. And of course, the whole idea of developing bays and waterways and looking at property values that can result from proximity to water's edge. And then we started to look at grains of cities, city blocks. This is Venice, of course, with its canal. And this is Savannah, Georgia, which was very interesting. Started
with a civic square and a block, and then they repeated this pattern of squares and blocks as the city grew. And to this day, Savannah, Georgia is one of the most interesting small American cities to visit because they kept this pattern going. And of course, this is New Delhi. This is the traditional pattern, and you can see what happens when the automobile came. The whole scale of the city started to change. On the other hand, that's Tokyo, and once again, the old traditional pattern overlaid with what happens with automobiles. And we have to be very conscious of this to try to find the right grain for this new city. And of course, the great pedestrian streets of Europe, the Ramblas, you know, when I was doing the Canada Pavilion in Sevilla, you know, it was a great treat to always to walk the Ramblas. And then we thought about traditional Chinese cities. And one of the interesting things about traditional Chinese cities or even older cities in Asia, this idea of mixed use. And zoning is something new in China. So they were all keen to copy North American zoning or British zoning, you know, separate housing from industry, separate places of business from rent. We said, no, we're changing all that. We now believe in mixed use. And mixed use is in your tradition. So, you know, so that takes a long time to kind of, you know, talk about that and make them understand that the theories of the 50s and the Russian theories are no longer the theories that we take today in North America. And then interesting historical patterns where this is a Roman city that became an Arabic city over time. This is an Arabic city that became Roman over time. And on this side is the city of Baltimore. When it first developed, what does it say? I think in 1867 or something like that. Yeah, 18, can't read it. Anyways, and then when the railways came, and then this is what happens when the automobile came. Right? These are all in the same scale. So that whole question of sprawl and how to deal with the automobile. And then we said to them, well, you know, in terms of the program, how big should this new city be? And the chief planner said, well, the mayor said about 1 million. Then we said, well, how sure are you of that? And they said, well, we're not sure. Maybe you should design it so it could be 1 million or 3 million or 5 million, just so we can hedge our bets. So we came back and we said, well, look, we better look at this more seriously. So then we did some research on other cities. This is Vancouver, this is Hong Kong, this is San Francisco, and this is Frankfurt. And, you know, some are 1 million and some are 6 million. And interesting enough, there is a scale, there is an order, because city centers in terms of face-to-face interaction, it's about 15-20 minute walk. That's about what people can take. So it didn't matter, you know, if you look at the city of Vancouver today, you know, the downtown is not gonna shift, the downtown will just get denser. You look at Hong Kong, same thing has happened since the 1950s. So you may get downtowns that jump, but when they pass a certain scale beyond the walking distance, they tend not to work anymore. So we said, now there's an idea. Maybe what we can do is, well, that's Houston on the other side. That's what not to do, right? Where they just let, they're very proud, there's no zoning in Houston. Right? And you can build anything, anywhere, as long as you have the guts to do that. We show this slide a lot. We said to control land in terms of supply and demand, to do some rough doodles and sketches. This green shows the hills. The red shows this big highway that they built. And one of the things that really unfortunately happened with the highway was that it was running in the opposite direction of the drainage patterns. Right? And because of the tidal flats, you see there's the salt farms, and because of the tidal differences, and because, as Dong Yang says, the rain comes within 1 month of the year, that they actually, what they did is they built a dike with that freeway. So, you know, on our third visit when we went there, which was right after the rain, all this area was flooded,
right? Because the roadway was built high enough so that it was above high tide. The tidal changed about, just like Vancouver, about 16 feet. Very similar. So this bloody highway was up, you know, 20 feet from where ground was, right, at low tide. So we have to really think, how are we going to deal with this? I mean, it was built, it was there, it was under the major arterial. How do you deal with it? So we said, okay, these are some of the patterns of the salt farms. We knew that they were filling all of this. They wanted to fill this highway, so they wanted to fill the rest of this. Well, just like we did with False Creek, right? And so that was an easy way to get real estate. So they were taking down all these hills that were here, that were here, that were back here. They were just bulldozing them down to get filled, to fill this land. And we said, no, stop. We have to think about cut and fill. We're not going to fill everything. So we did some diagrams to show them how you could balance cut and fill to create more water. They said, well, we don't want more water. We already have enough water. We want more land. We said, no. If you get more water's edge, the land will become more valuable, and therefore your tax base would be better than allowing the city to sprawl. So these are a couple of diagrams. One was that this was that number 9 major road. We said, okay, well, maybe we could put the city this way. The low tide line was way out here, so we said maybe we'll create a lagoon, create an inner bay, take care of the typhoons with a built form to shelter the winds as it comes through, and then create an inner basin. But the trouble with that one was that it was a great kind of interesting city, but it wasn't a waterfront city. It didn't feel like a waterfront city. So we then had this idea of turning it 90 degrees. We said, okay, assuming we can find a way of crossing this major road with series of cut and fill, that's your low tide line. So you present a small frontage to the typhoon, and then creating these kind of inner bays, which, you know, inspiration from English Bay, from Kitsilano looking down to the downtown, you know, that's about the right scale. And then some smaller bays like False Creek in this area, and then thereby allowing the water to drain to the ocean and deal with the flooding. So these are some kind of early sketches, that kind of brainstorming ideas. And then we came along with our preliminary plan, which then developed a series of what we call character areas, which was developed in Vancouver, actually, for controlling the downtown. So each of these character areas are mixed-use areas, creating a major greenway down the center. This is a traditional path. Remember the video where I was walking through the woods? These are where the trees were. So we said, look, let's save those trees and build on that as your major spine in the core. And you always are walking, there's an existing village here, and the villagers always walked from this village to the sea anyway, so why not tie that in and have this village, rather than bulldoze it, have it as the market garden village that grows the market vegetables for this future city. Instead of moving out all the fishermen that are here, develop a fishing market in this area so that they can come in and, like Granville Island Market, sell their produce and sell their catch. Develop an inner basin. You know, we all love our fireworks in English Bay. So the idea of, you know, a really large water body that acts as an amphitheater for large celebrations. And then in this outer tip here, use it mostly for government buildings, also your cruise ship terminals and your those viewing ocean towers were then on this edge, and then some other neighborhoods that are in this area. And so this spine we studied, you know, these are kind of traditional. This is the Imperial Palace all the way out to the Temple of Heaven in China. The series of open and close. So we said, look, maybe we will take this spine right through, but do it in a more, less formal way. But this spine then becomes, if you like, a
Well, it's a version of the Ramblas, but maybe a little bit like Stanley Park, except stretched out, you know, so that it's a more natural form. And then this bay here, where we would then ring with cultural buildings, there would be museums and galleries and, you know, planetariums and whatever, but the idea is a totally public park with no private buildings taking over the water's edge. And then most important of all, working with John Reedshaw at the San Juan Engineering, the idea of how to make this inner bay flushing. I think we have to give John the credit for this really whole idea of the city, because he said, look, let's work with nature. You know, if we narrow this channel here and we can then build these tidal, these walls at half the height, instead of 16 foot heights out here, these ones can be half, because it's like a bottle with a narrow neck. If you turn the bottle upside down, it takes a certain amount of time for the bottle to empty, but if halfway through you turn the bottle back up and you can fill it again, right? Everybody understand that, right? So you don't, you know, you're not getting the 16 foot tidal change. So the idea, we are able then to flush this inner bay, and you are still save a lot of money on the seawall. And so the fishermen then can take their boats in and do something. And so really, we won the competition really on the fact that, one, we saved them a lot of money on fill, because we didn't, I'll explain a little later why we didn't have, but most important, that we told them they saved a lot of money on building seawalls. Because when they built the linear city that they did, they had miles of seawall, 16 foot high, they had to build, but here, they had to cut their costs in half. And the idea of cut and fill. So these were some of our early models. There's that new economic zone that Dong Yang mentioned. I mean, that city with those photographs he showed you, that's all that building was in 10 years, right? With a population of, what, 100,000? Yeah. 10 years they built this, and then they ran out of room because they didn't build this with very good planning, so that's why we had to build this one, right? So we had to show how this one was linking to this one in terms of scale. And so instead of having a sandwich, you remember the earlier map, they had red here, yellow here, and, you know, typical strip planning, industry, housing. We then turned it around and made it a series of kind of concentric rings, and using this bay really as a way of forcing the city to grow in the middle rather than sprawling, right? So these are some of the, this is a shot down that number 9 road, that big wide road, and then the idea of looking through this axis to see the city and making sure the building heights are lower than the surrounding hills, and then coming the other way once again. I mean, one of the great things about Vancouver is you go across Granville Street Bridge and you discover downtown, right? Or when you're coming from the university and you come down Spanish Bank and there's the city. So the idea of using vistas and surprise and unfolding of views. So these are some aerial shots of this model that we built. There's that parkway through the center. And there's that water body itself. And then some of the canals that we've kept on the salt farms. And then a train station linking to a series of ferry terminals. And then having a lot of the roadways on axis with the hills, so that when you're in the hills, you can always look through the city and see the ocean, right? This is that small bay, and the big kiln bays on this side, small kiln bays on this side. We also have to salt most of the buildings away from the prevailing winds, because this port is going to be 4 times larger than the Port of Vancouver. And it's going to have bulk exports of, you know, bulk wheat and all kinds of other things. So we have to be careful that the wind was not going to drive the pollutants to the city. These are some of the water edge conditions. These are these ocean watching towers that we mentioned. And then we have to test. So these are the grains of the various cities that we've talked about, and then this is the grain of the city that we are trying to do. So we wanted to make sure, grain-wise, it was not out of scale. We actually picked a typical Vancouver block, and we liked the lanes, the laneways in Vancouver. Vancouver is one of the few cities in North America that have lanes, and the lanes take a lot of the service traffic off the main streets. Right? Also, we thought the lanes also, later on, if required, you can convert them to bicycle ways or pedestrian ways, so it gave us an extra module, if you like, to work on in terms of scale. And then with Paul Bunt, the traffic engineer in Vancouver, we tested this with a series of computer simulations to see, you know, what the bottlenecks may be with these grid network that we had. And then we started to lay out some of the streets. The typical street we came back to pretty well, kind of a Vancouver scale of street widths, and also we then said, okay, what would go wrong? What can you do with these streets? So we did a series of diagrams, assuming that we're going to accept this typical width. By the way, we got very popular. We said to them, don't fill any more land, because this level is your normal low tide level, right? You see, you already have free underground parking. Because if you leave this and you build from here and you only fill where you're going to build the roads, then the surrounding buildings can butt up to your street level and save yourself a lot of money and not have to cut down as many hills. And then so you could see that drawing to these drawings showing various ways of, you know, if you didn't have tramways in the middle of the street, you would then have bicycle ways, and you could then have three lanes of traffic with greenery in the middle, wider sidewalks, or you could have, you know, when you get to the station situation where you have light rapid transit or rapid transit, and then you can have your boulevards wider in the center, you can then have wider sidewalks and have two lanes of traffic. In addition to that, we also said to them, look, if you leave the road and not fill any more than you have to, this diagram doesn't show it, you could put all your servicing. You just build concrete culverts before you fill, and you can do all your servicing under the street without digging the street up every time like we do in Vancouver, right? I mean, you know, they have this tremendous asset that they didn't see before. They saw the filling as a necessity. Now they understand, oh, we have something here that, you know, we could use. And then we talked about district cooling, district heating, breaking down the heating into different zones. And then we looked at, was mentioned in the video, the whole idea of breaking down sewage treatment into smaller packages. You know, I think we have to do more buildings like the Troy buildings, you know, because you can't tell people in the third world, why don't you do this when we don't have anything to show here ourselves? Right? I mean, they say, well, why do you force these new ideas on us when you don't have the guts to try it yourself? So these are some renderings that show, you know, some of the, these. This is going through that area where I mentioned where we have these fishing markets. And then this shows how we handle the 16-foot tide difference. So that, you know, they love to swim, so at low tide they can still swim at that edge. These are ocean watching towers, right? And then when the tide comes in, at each one of these levels, you gradually lose one level at a time. And so this is what, you know, this is the fireworks, right? So we won the competition because we always took them to Vancouver. We said, see how beautiful it is? Because you're going to have a city just like Vancouver. So I think without further ado, that should be enough. So thank you very much.
Can I just say a few more words? Thank you. I think before I close, you know,
none of all this work could occur without a lot of people helping, and I really feel I have to recognize some people. First of all, I want to recognize Patrick Reed. Patrick was the commissioner of the port, who sees the one that said, look, Bing, forget about the rest of China, just go to Dalian. He's the one that trimmed Vancouver with Dalian as a port, and it makes a lot of sense because, you know, in Shanghai and Guangzhou, we're just a small fish in a big pond, but in Dalian, we're a big fish in a small pond. And secondly, their exports and their products are exactly the same as Pacific Northwest. Huh? Fruit and vegetable, seafood, timber, mining, oil and gas, and we're building in a northern climate. We know how to build a northern climate. Southern Chinese from Hong Kong and Taiwan, they don't know how to build in northern climates. So, you know, that was a very good fit for us. From my office, Michael Heaney, who's the associate in the office, who has to handle all the work when we're away running all over the world. Luciano Zago, who's the design architect, who did much of the design work on this. Brom Wiseman, where's Brom? There is. Brom helped us with a lot of the historical work on model town, model cities, telling us what not to do and all the mistakes that we made in the West. And engineers, Peter Jones from Paul Bunt's office over there. And Wilson Chen, is Wilson here from Keen Engineering? No? Ah, okay. Anyways, there he is. So you have questions about sewage treatment, water recycling, Wilson's here. Last but not least, I think we have to recognize Mrs. Anita Chan, Anita Lee. Is she here, Mrs. Lee? Well, this study was sponsored by a immigrant family from Malaysia who became Canadians, and they invested in Dalian, and they really sponsored this study. So without their assistance, none of this would have happened. So, thank you.
Thank you. We have our usual question period now. Who wants to start? Question here in the front.
How many airports do you plan for Dalian?
That's it, yes. How many airports do you plan for Dalian? Well, that wasn't part of our job, but it is a very important question. We repeatedly have said to them, this new city would not succeed without a new airport. The present airport is in the bottleneck area, very close to Old Dalian. The closest analogy to that would be the Metro Airport in Toronto. You know, it's smack close to the core, and there's no room to expand. If they build a new airport, it would be very close to this new city. There's always the question between the new city and the old city, which is going to become the major city. It's like San Francisco and Oakland, right? I mean, so we don't know. I think right now, I don't think there's been a firm decision from the civil government as to which city will become the major city. They just know they want to get this one started.
Yes. Sure.
I'd like to ask you, from your work on Dalian, have you learned any recommendations you would make for the city of Vancouver?
Repeat the question.
From the work that we've done in Dalian, do we have a recommendation for the city of Vancouver? Oh boy, that's Well, I guess I'll be very blunt. One of the problems we have now in Western society is I think we have basically democracy of the minority. And everything is compromised and dissected over so many times, any good idea is long lost. The one problem with, of course, working in China is that things are faster, decisions are made quicker. You also can make bigger mistakes too. But on the other hand, I think we're losing a lot of efficiency with the way we are heading. We must find a way to simplify our ways of governing our own cities. One good example is, you know, I've recently been involved in these, you know, three convention center competitions. You know? I mean, it's an enormous process that's taking so much energy that I think we're just navel-gazing, you know? Any one of the three schemes would be a wonderful convention center. We should just get on with it.
Questions? Way back there.
Question was, you know, it's a wonderful opportunity, it's fantastic, what are the chances of getting a job? I just have to remind everybody, the city of Vancouver was laid out by a man named Bartholomew in 1929, is it, Brom? Around that time. And how much of that plan exists today? You know, I mean, what you see on the slideshow tonight, what will be 5 years from now, it's already going to be very different. Every day we're compromising, every day we're adjusting, and quite rightly so, because this is a Chinese city in China, planned and built by the Chinese people. Bing Tom's not going to build every building in the city. I mean, most, you know, these wonderful stories of my having worked for the next 30 years, I mean, I'd be lucky to have worked for the next month.
Depends on Dong Yang, you know, when now he's on his toes.
But, you know, every day the plans are changing, every day things are happening. We're trying to backseat drive as best we can, but there's no blank check to say go and do it.
Yeah. We have the gentleman on the front.
Ben, how resilient is your plan to some of these scenarios on global warming and sea level rise?
Right. I think Peter asked, how resilient is the plan to global warming and sea level rise? That's a very, very good question. And Dong Yang tells me, what was it now? We did a study on this problem because I think China, a lot of the coastal cities of China are going to be in deep, deep trouble. We, in some discussion with John Reachow, our marine engineer, have made some allowances to bring the levels up higher. But even John said, well, look, how are you going to deal with this? Are you going to say for the next 30 years, next 40 years, next 100 years, next 150 years? So quite frankly, a lot of these are stab in the dark and you just do the best you can. But we did deal with the issue. We came to the conclusion that we couldn't deal with it very well. and that the new Dalian city is not going to be any worse than, you know, 200 other coastal cities in China, including Shanghai and Hong Kong and etc.
Or Venice.
Or Venice.
Question over here.
I'm interested in the aspects of transport, storage, and so forth. The entrepot aspect of Talia. Does this enter into your plans at all?
Right.
And, for example, yes, the huge space needed for container ports.
Right, right. Very, very good question.
Repeat the question.
The question was, yes, the question was the port, the infrastructure requirement for the port. which is, you know, this is a city that's servicing 110 million people, and what's the relationship between that kind of infrastructure requirement for the port to the new city? Well, the big Kiln Bay that was on the map is the new port immediately next to small Kiln Bay, which is where we're building our city. And so we were very worried whether or not, you know, they asked us to build this small city, and so it's like the earlier question. The airport and the port was absolutely critical, and the railway was the third link. And so we kept saying, well, when is the port going to happen? Because if the port does not come about, obviously the city will not happen. But obviously in the 3 years that we've been working, the Singaporeans have signed on with China to build a new port, which is going to be one of the largest ports in the world. And so just out of interest, we then asked the Singaporeans, why would you invest, I think it'd be $3 billion plus on this new port? And they said, well, Singapore is in the Strait of Malacca, is directly in line with all the Spratly Islands. What's your bet that within the next 20 years there won't be a blow up on the Spratly Islands because of the, you know, competing? So when we build the Dalian port, we now have an alternate way to Europe through the land bridge, through the railway system, through Russia, railway system through China to Europe, and we can ship from Japan and Korea much shorter time than shipping by sea. So there are these major changes that's happening from transportation that's, you know, going to change the way we think about how goods are moved through the world. So the new city is now, I think, quite certain, because Singaporeans have said we are going to build a port.
Since there's one over here, and then we're coming over there, and here first.
At what level is the decision making taking place? Is it local government, or is it central government?
Right.
Who makes the decision, and who gives the approval?
Okay. The question was, at what level are all the decisions being made about the new city, and is it city level, provincial level, or federal level? It's a mixture of everything. Things are changing very rapidly in China, and there's a lot of jockeying for position. For example, the mayor of Dalian, we're in Dalian because of the mayor. This is an extraordinary person, very unusual, very forward-looking. He graduated in media relations from University of California, Los Angeles. This guy can run circles around any politicians we have in North America. You could tell from that video, right? I mean, he was a very charismatic man. He's the son of Bo Yibo. Bo Yibo was the finance minister of China for years. Equivalent to Deng Xiaoping, there's these five octogenarians, there was five, but Bo Yibo is one of them. So he's the son, so he's what's called, quote, princeling, right? He's slated to go up. He was offered the position of deputy foreign minister, he turned it down. He either wanted to be foreign minister or nothing. Dongyan says he's recently been offered the minister of foreign trade. We don't know if he's going to take that position. There's also talk recently that he may become head of Hong Kong-Macau affairs post-97, but he is going to go up. He has been the driving force for all of Dalian. Now, the new city itself, there are politics involved. There's another vice mayor who looks after the new city. And the mayor of Dalian himself has his priority. The mayor of the new economic zone has his priority. They don't necessarily get along. There's, you know, internal jockeying of position. Right now, everything has been pretty well put on hold as of this last year, because I think, you know, China has had this tremendous boom And there's overbuilding in Shanghai, overbuilding in Guangzhou, overbuilding in Shenzhen. So all the new economic zones have been told to just hold off for a while. They have to reallocate priorities. To build this new city is going to take hundreds of millions of dollars in infrastructure, water, gas, sewage. That all has to come from the central government or some foreign investor. So you know that has to be sorted out. So it's short answer is it's not clear.
Question way back there first.
Yeah, I want to ask a question on what kind of role will the bicycle play in these?
Very, very good question. Yes.
Yes. Right. 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 Multiple
motor
vehicles.
Right.
And yeah. Are you going
to
put bicycle to bicycle?
Yeah. Like
you do here,
okay. Yeah. Excellent question. This is a question we really sweated over for a long time.
Repeat the question.
The question was bicycles. What's the role of bicycle? What our thoughts about bicycle? Those of us in the West have a preconception that all of China is bicycle. It's not true. Only certain major cities, Guangzhou, Shanghai, Beijing, and a few other cities. In Darwin, there are very few bicycles. What happened was when the Soviets pulled out, all the oil and gas was stopped. And so Mao encouraged people to use bicycles. But in certain other areas where they didn't experience the shortage, bicycle did not become the norm. So Darwin, interesting enough, I think from the Japanese legacy, has an excellent public transport system. And generally what's happening in China today, from my understanding, is that they feel that even though in the West we have a romance about the bicycle, whenever we go there and we talk about it, they said, well, look, they said, on a winter day when it's cold and snowing and I'm going to work and I'm wearing my suit and I get to my office, I'm soaking wet, would you want to go to the office this way? And of course, we have, you know, shower rooms and all that in our offices, but they don't, right? So to them, the bicycle is actually not seen the same way as we see the bicycle. So they would much rather invest in public transit systems. For us, we left our options open, like we show in the cross sections. But the reason we did not focus it as much was simply because of the particular situation of Dalian.
Next question, one over here.
This is sort of the same question, different aspect. You did mention public transportation, but as the Chinese get richer, and they see the private car.
Yes.
And we look at Vancouver, which right. I think is being destroyed by the private car.
Right.
What provision have you for this?
Well, our solution was that, I guess, the question was provision back to bicycles, cars, conflict between bicycles and cars. There was one other part I have to talk a little bit about first. When you have three modes of transit between pedestrian, bicyclists, and cars, it's a very difficult situation to resolve, especially on the right-hand turns. You can deal with two of the modes, bicycle and people, or cars and people, or bicycle and cars, but when you have three modes together, it became very, very difficult. So our thoughts were that let's create the fixed links as fast as we can, so we kept talking to them about streetcars, because we felt that if you put the emphasis on the streetcars on grade, you will then fix the main arterials that will become commercial streets. You will then, in a way, force the car into a secondary position. With the bicyclists, we didn't get very far with them. It was just a difference in value systems. They just did not see why we would want to encourage them to use bicycle when they don't use bicycles already now. China has gone through a very major debate between, you know, people in city planning and the Ministry of Machinery. Ministry of Machinery wants to build as many car plants as possible because that's going to drive the economy, have enormous spin-offs for many other industry, and people in city planning are saying, look, if you do that, you're going to destroy all the Chinese cities, learn from the West. That debate is still going on. Right now, the hopeful sign is that legally, individuals, Dongyang, I think, individuals are not allowed to buy cars. You have to buy it through certain corporations, and that has, you know, kept the lid on the growth of private automobile, but because of corruptions and under the table deals, obviously that's a problem. But Paul Bunn, who's a traffic engineer, said that the statistics were showing in Dalian that the automobile rate of growth was 25% per year.
Yes. Question way back there.
What if New Dalian's telecommunication infrastructure, starting with fiber optics?
Well, telecommunication, whether or not we're dealing with fiber optics, yes, this is something we've talked to them about, and we advised them to build it in to the infrastructural system. But so far, I have to say it wasn't our priorities right now. We're still trying to deal with sewage and water.
Good question here.
Can I just ask, the name of this city, Dalian, sounds quite Western.
Yes.
Where did the name come from, and does it have meaning?
Yes.
And apropos of what the other gentleman was saying about moving people within your city, is there any thought to subway in this city?
Right. Question was, where did the name Dalian came from? Dalian came, I think Dr. Liu mentioned, is a Russian word, Dalian, meaning faraway, remote place, a faraway place, right? Before that, the English name was Port Arthur. I call it the doormat of China, right? I mean, the British were there first, the Russians were there, the Japanese were there, Koreans had been there. It wasn't even a Han city, it was a Manchurian city. It was, you know. So you can see it's strategically located. Subways, the other question was, you know, yes, they are planning on subways. Old Dalian has now a call for proposal for a complete subway system. And obviously we're trying to push Bombardier and, you know, into Dalian to try and do a subway system.
Yes. You have a question here?
Oh, do I enjoy designing new cities? Love it.
Question back there. We have three more questions.
You mentioned water conservation, and my question concerns the waste management, both from the industrial waste, the human waste, and air quality. What planning is there for this massive expansion in the population and industrial growth? There has been a problem of water pollution, sea pollution. How is this perceived and managed?
Yes, that's a question is on water pollution, air pollution, sewage treatment, right? We're very conscious of these problems, and we keep trying to explain to them. Because they're very short of water. They get one third or one quarter of the water that we have in Vancouver annually. So we keep talking about gray water, recycling of gray water, using gray water to irrigate the street trees and the green spaces. They have tried that in Old Dalian, interestingly enough, over the past 10, 15 years. Much of the problem in China is management. I don't think there's a shortage of willingness to try new ideas. But what's happening, I think, under the communist system still, because it's public money and public space, you know, new buildings after 5 years look like a building that's 30 years old. Like they don't maintain well. They haven't had that tradition yet. In terms of industrial pollution, that's a very, very serious concern. And I think that they're beginning to try to deal with it because I think they've had some disastrous consequences in areas where people have, masses number of people have become ill because of that. Even for myself, every trip I go to China, I get sick in China. You know, and usually we're very careful. 10, 15 years ago, this wasn't a problem. Maybe I'm just getting older, but it's it's a serious, serious problem.
Two more questions. Who's going to compete for the last two questions? We're going to have one here and then one way back there.
What do you envision as the building material? Are they going to build steel?
Right. The question is building material, what I envisage. Well, I believe in using material that's readily at hand, so we try to always encourage that. One of the problems within, I guess, most developing countries is they say, well, we want what you have. I mean, if you have it, why can't we have it? It's the same question about automobiles. So obviously, a lot of the commercial buildings are going to be, commercial buildings are used as symbols of progress, and so there are a lot of buildings that are importing building products from the West, especially in the big cities like Shanghai and Guangzhou. We have been trying to explain to them to try to use local material, local products, but it's going to take a while. And even when we talk about simple technology like concrete blocks, right now they're building with mud bricks off the soil, off the land. The central government has put out a directive, especially in the Dalian area, don't do that anymore because it was stripping off the topsoil. So we had this bright idea, we said, okay, concrete blocks, right? We can do that. It's good technology from the West, they don't have that. But then when you think it through, it's not just building a concrete block plant, you've got to train all the workers. It's a different way of working. It's a different method of finishing a building. We had this problem in Spain when we built the Canada Pavilion. We specified drywalls. We thought that was pretty simple for Spain, you know, drywalls. So they built drywall, and you get down the site, and they were putting in the drywall screws by hand with a screwdriver. It took them a lot longer to do drywall than they do in the West. He said, well, why don't you build brick walls like what we're used to, right? So this technical change in terms of material, I always believe in trying to use the local crafts. Also employs people better. If you bring in too much technological change too quick, you just create unemployment. But there is the question of image or modernity, right? So we have to find the balance.
The question, last question, the way back there.
I'm sorry? Well, sure.
Repeat the question.
The question is, disability, user-friendly, people with disability. Yes, I think that is something that we are trying to convey to our Chinese colleagues. It's not always well received because they feel there is a priority that they prioritize, and unfortunately within the Chinese culture, people with disability is not still seen as an issue of human rights, an issue of equality.
Thank you. Okay. But before I ask Terence McGee to come and thank our speaker tonight, one or two things I want to say about our program. You will want to go out, rush out and buy a membership, because we have now, or just ahead of us, two
talks which will have overflow audiences like tonight. Next week, we have Joseph Rotblat, who won last year's Nobel Peace Prize, and he's coming to talk about how to get rid of nuclear weapons. He's been one of the people in the world as influential as anyone in getting where we are with nuclear weapons, and I know we will have a large crowd for that. 2.5 weeks from now, in the middle of the week, which happens rarely, we have a Croatian poet, Slavenka Draculic, who's, you want to read about her? Read yesterday's New York Times. And she's a well-known author, and there's going to be an overflow audience. We can get her only on a Wednesday. It'll be a special Wednesday evening lecture on March 12th. Of course, we will have Saturday lectures that week and the following week as well. But those two particular talks, I think, are going to attract very large audiences, and you are now warned to come early on that evening, particularly the people who were improvident today. So please join the Institute as you go out. And I'm now going to ask Terence McGee, the head of the Asian Studies Institute at UBC, to thank our speaker.